Let's talk a little bit. But so I think there are two main possibilities here. So one of them is that you start from knowing ADS CFT, and then time evolves, and you figure out this thing in a fairly straightforward way. And I guess the other possibility is that it's much more complicated to start from ADS CFT and then ever figure out anything about the more general space times, and it might not be a good career move. So I'm gonna be optimistic and take the belief that if we think about ADS CFT hard enough, maybe we can learn some lessons for how to describe things more generally. So I'll start with a couple of insights that I like that are probably still just conjectural lessons, maybe not completely well established, but ways that I like to think about things in ADS CFT. So there's one statement that in some ways is obvious, but it has some content to it. So space-time emerges from, so you start with these non-perturbative degrees of freedom, which don't live in the space-time. You put those degrees of freedom in a particular state or some class of states. And for that class of states, you have a geometry description. So you could say that space-time emerges from entangling these degrees of freedom. And I say entangling the degrees of freedom instead of coupling or interacting, just because there are now some nice pieces of evidence that if you want to more or less directly read off geometrical structure rather than something like correlation functions or Wilson lines or some of these more stringy things, then the entanglement data from the field theory is a nice way to do that. So Ryu and Takinagi's proposal, for example, is that if you choose some region of the boundary, that the entanglement entropy for that region with the complement is equal to the area of the minimal surface in the bulk, as long as for Einstein gravity. And so that area is not a string action or a brain action or anything. It's sort of directly a geometrical thing. So you have this correspondence between something like a universal observable in quantum mechanics and a universal kind of observable in gravity. Although Rob will tell you that, like black hole entropy formulas, if you have higher derivative terms in your gravity action, that things should be appropriately modified. And then there are other observations you can make about certain geometries in ADS CFT that have multiple asymptotic regions. And actually, I can mention later an even simpler example where you literally have a formula that says that if you take a quantum superposition of disconnected things in the right way, then you get a connected geometry. So maybe this is helpful, that this idea that you can patch together space-times by entangling some non-perturbative degrees of freedom. So related to that, so when you start thinking about entangling things, then the natural way to think about subsystems is by a density matrix. So in general, in a quantum system, if you have a state and you want to ask what captures everything we know about part of that quantum system, then the answer is a density matrix. And it turns out that in ADS CFT, there are, again, examples, and I don't know how general a statement it is, but there are clear examples where a certain part of a space-time more or less directly corresponds to a particular density matrix. So starting with this, similar to examples, so say in an eternal black hole, this description we have of having two CFTs and one of them being entangled with the other, then it's more or less clear that the density matrix that you get from this side is, which is a thermal density matrix, is really associated with this side. you don't have to, when you just, if I just give you the density matrix, I have no reason to say that has to come from this eternal black hole. It could just be representing some ensemble of pure states in one CFT, or it could probably be coming from some more complicated geometry where possibly something was glued into this side, or you change something over here that has no effect on this black hole. So that corresponds to the fact that a given density matrix could be purified in various ways in quantum mechanics. Another example that I'll talk about later is related to the familiar statement that if you take the Poincaré patch of ADS, then that has a dual, which is Yang-Mills theory on Minkowski space. So if you started with the global picture in any state and then considered some particular Poincaré patch, then there should be a state of a CFT on Minkowski space that corresponds to the physics in that patch. Well, you can look at smaller patches. So this would be some particular ball on the boundary and with what's called its causal evolution or something. So it's another way to say it is the intersection of the interior of this backward light cone with this forward light cone. So as I'll describe a little bit more detail later, like the Poincaré patch, this thing has a dual. So the boundary of this region in ADS is a hyperbolic space. And in different coordinates, this is what's known as a hyperbolic or a topological black hole. But since that space has a particular boundary, asymptotically ADS boundary geometry, our standard dictionary tells us that it has a dual, which is this hyperbolic space times time. A slightly more subtle feature is that the dual, so you can ask, well, what state of this theory corresponds to the pure ADS? And it's actually a density matrix. So you can understand on general grounds that knowing this part of the space-time doesn't tell you about the whole space-time. And I think it's maybe a general principle that one should then expect your description to be a density matrix rather than a pure state. Sure. No, I think it's a perfectly good quantum system to look at the CFT on Minkowski space. It's just that the time evolution from minus infinity to infinity in that CFT is only interpreted as some time evolution in coordinates that do this. So it's that's right. The Poincaré patch, because it extends over the whole thing, has the same slice at t equals zero, then okay. So I think it's a pure state, but so I think what the CFT gives you in terms of the bulk is a fairly direct bulk interpretation inside the Poincaré patch. Of course, there's some information there. So the information outside the Poincaré patch is behind the Poincaré horizon. Presumably, if you wanted to, I mean, if you cared, there would be some complicated way of figuring it out from the CFT, but the condensed matter CMT people don't care about the bulk side at all. So they're just working within the Poincaré patch and going the other way. Well, that's sort of like, I mean, there's an equivalent statement for the eternal black hole here, where if you formed it from a shell, then surely there's a pure state, and there's surely no asymptotic region over here. Yeah. So one of the difficult things about cosmological spacetimes, certain cosmological spacetimes, seems to be that there isn't necessarily a causal patch that has complete information about the space. So if you think that these causal patches should be associated with some density matrices, then you might think that this implies that it would be difficult maybe to give a full description in terms of some pure state. I've already given an example where your patch doesn't cover the whole space-time, but you somehow write down a pure state. But in some ways, it might be more natural to think about a description where you have density matrices associated with specific causal patches. So what I want to do is think about this De Sitter example. Yeah. Sure. Yeah, sure. There are a lot of difficult things about De Sitter, all I'm going to do is look at ADS, and I'm going to ask, what can I do that looks as close as possible to De Sitter? Look at the description there, and then ask whether the ultimate description of De Sitter, which I have nothing to specific to speculate about, might have some of those features. So just to remind you, in De Sitter, this is what one particular observer has access to. Here's another picture. And then from the static patch picture, the physics you experience is that things will accelerate away from you to the horizon. There's also this thermal character, which is probably naturally associated with imagining that there's some kind of thermal density matrix. Okay. So I want to go from ADS and think about some analogy. And so somehow to make it look more like De Sitter, I wanted to imagine just taking a slice of ADS. And so it could be any, eventually it could be any asymptotically ADS geometry. But I want to think of this slice of ADS so that I have something like a future and a past boundary. And instead of trying to give a global description of this thing, I want to ask, well, what is the description that is most relevant to a set of accelerating observers? So we can imagine choosing a family of observers all the way around, or there'd be a sphere worth. And so each observer has maybe some constant acceleration, so they start at the boundary, come in, and go out. Okay. So the point is that this family of observers is, in some ways, qualitatively similar, or what they experience is qualitatively similar to the physics in De Sitter space. So if you think about any one, so this is our hyperbolic black hole again. If you think of any one of these observers, then what they're in some patch. That patch has a horizon. Again, typically things that objects would appear to them to be falling into that horizon. There's some thermal character to the horizon. We didn't have this boundary in ADS, and so I'll have to talk about the last part of the talk is related to how to get rid of the boundary. So as I mentioned before, even though there's some nice description of the whole thing in ADS, that's not the description that's most relevant to these observers. And so what I want to do is ask, well, what is the description that most directly tells you about the physics from the point of view of these observers in ADS space? And so then it's natural to think about the dual of this part of the geometry. And as I said before, so if we're in the vacuum, in the ADS vacuum, then the dual is a density matrix. But as I learned from this paper, it's actually exactly a thermal. So it's a thermal state of the CFT on HD times time. And so the full thing then is that you have, for a given space-time, this family of geometries, or sorry, this family of density matrices corresponding to the various observers. And it might not be obvious that that should be true. So I said that for ADS, but what about more general spacetimes that are just asymptotically ADS? Okay, well, the same thing turns out to be true. So if you take an arbitrary state for the global spacetime, then the boundary structure is still the same. And so we can, from the CFT point of view, still consider the same set of patches. You have these, if you take a ball, which I'm assuming to be half of the sphere, and consider the causal development of that ball, so that's a part of your CFT. But there's a conformal map that takes that to HD times time. So this is what's behind the fact that you had a hyperbolic space boundary for that thing. So you have this conformal map between these two things. And so then there's a map at the level of the CFT quantum mechanics, where you could start with a state of the full theory, so that'd be a state of the conformal field theory on the sphere. Now tracing over the rest of the ball, the rest of the sphere, would give you a density matrix in the original quantum field theory corresponding to that ball. And then this conformal map then tells me I can make some unitary transformation to get me a density matrix for the theory on the hyperbolic space. Okay. So you can see then that starting with any ADS spacetime or any state, really any state in this non-perturbative description, you have another description of most directly of this particular slice of ADS, which looks like a family of density matrices. And in this case, the density matrices are not arbitrary, so they have some constraints. For example, so this is a constraint, right? If you demand that starting with one pure state, you get the whole family of density matrices. You can write down specific constraints on say the density matrices corresponding to two complementary parts. So since those should give you complete information about the space-time, you have constraints like the spectrum of rho, call it A, equals the spectrum of rho A bar. Yeah. Oh, sorry. So I'm trying. Yeah. So this is supposed to be the complement of the, yeah. Bars. Oh, so HD times time is still on the boundary. So that was the boundary of our hyperbolic black hole. So if you write down this particular diamond, then there's a conformal transformation that takes me to, when I say conformal transformation, I mean on the metrics of this diamond. No, I mean in the back. So think about quantum field theory. It's sort of like a quantum field theory and curved space-time thing. So if I write down the metric, I'm working with a conformal field theory. If I write down the metric on this particular diamond, I can see that it's some factor times the metric of HD times time. And yeah, I think I learned this from you, but the diamond is on the boundary. Okay, yeah, sorry. Right, the point was that these patches I was talking about before, well, I don't, if I want to talk about a general description, I want to avoid assuming some geometry for the inside. So I think we have to be careful if we're trying to come up with a general description for the whole ensemble of space-times. It can't really rely on something that is specific to the geometry inside, because probably most of the states don't have a geometry. If there is a bulk space time, yeah. Well, Yeah. That's right. So really the logic here is that in ADS spacetime, the correspondence is clear. And now I generalize away from ADS spacetime. I don't want to talk about spacetime anymore. I just want to note that the same, I can still, this family of density matrices description still exists, and I'm arguing that just from the CFT point of view, even after I've eliminated the, even after I've stopped thinking about the bulk spacetime. Okay, so even for states that may have no good geometrical description where it wouldn't really make sense to ask what region of the bulk spacetime, I'm still convinced that there's some family of density matrices that give me a good description. But it's probably true. Oh, well, okay, so that's right. I mean, that's kind of the last thing. You can interpret properties of that. So when there is a good geometrical description, then this density matrix, actually in this example, it's interesting. So this density matrix in the original picture, the von Neumann entropy of that, according to Ryu and Takinagi, should tell me about an area, which for ADS happens to be also the area of a horizon, which is the horizon of this black hole. I'm going to divorce this slide. Okay, so so this is kind of it for the ADS story. So we get a description which is kind of relevant to a part of this space-time which you can think of as being associated with these cosmological observers or the accelerating observers, and that description looks like some family of density matrices with some constraints, and the density matrices are labeled by boundary data, and so that's obviously a big problem with trying to go to De Sitter. Now you might say, well, I could actually label these density matrices by points on the future, or probably more precisely a pair of points, one on the future and one on the past, and that might be something that extends or that's more natural when you go to De Sitter space. But I don't want to push that too far. The thing that I want to focus on for the rest of the talk is the other thing that's kind of non-De Sitter about this is that these patches all have boundaries, and obviously in De Sitter space your patches do not have boundaries. And so what would be better if I still want to take the approach of learning something from ADS CFT that might be applicable, what would be better is if I could give a description within ADS CFT of something like this in the bulk. Okay. All right. So now I'm talking about. So now it sounds like I'm going to do something much harder. But in fact, so I'm going to ask this question. So again, taking this density matrix philosophy, the natural question might be, well, what's the density matrix that describes this thing? And since we're talking about quantum field theory, and we know about this UVIR correspondence, then the question becomes, given a quantum field theory, is there a precise notion of a density matrix describing the infrared physics? Yeah, okay, so this is a separate aspect of the question that I'm now going to think about. But that's right. So if I knew that, let me give you the naive kind of answer where I could just say, okay, well, this thing, sometimes we talk about this part of the space-time as corresponding to a cutoff field theory. So instead of density matrices for some field theory on hyperbolic space, then we might think, well, this should be a density matrix for a cutoff field theory, and a cutoff field. So you get a little bit towards the types of things Eva was saying yesterday. So if I have a cutoff field theory and this is an ADS radius, then that's probably like a quantum mechanics. And then for De Sitter, you need at least one kind of complementary patch, so that would be like another quantum mechanics. But then the boundary here would would not be fixed, and you need some way of integrating over that. So that sounds like some gravity. So you know, in some ways, things that Eva was saying would arise from thinking about this vaguely. Oh yeah, sorry. So still this is ADS, and then the thing would be that, well, maybe it's as simple as changing your matrix model. So you know, this cutoff CFT is some particular matrix model. You know, if I, in the simplest of all possible worlds, the thing would be to then change the matrix model, and then instead of ADS, you get this. But probably it's not so simple. Okay, so thankfully I'm at a point of the talk where the rest of the talk will be very concrete and actually just refer to quantum field theory and not really have anything more to do with ADS, CFT, or cosmology specifically, because I'm going to be, for the most part, talking about perturbative quantum field theories that I understand somewhat better. Okay, So our question was, you know, is there a density matrix for the IR physics? There has been a lot of discussion in the literature recently about density matrices in quantum field theory, and I've alluded to some of that earlier in the talk. But just to remind you, so something that seems to span the string theory and condensed matter and quantum information community is this idea of looking at regions of quantum field theories. And then the argument is that by a locality, the Hilbert space splits up into a tensor product, which is the essential structure for defining density matrices. Given the density matrix for one part, you could calculate then various observables, like the entanglement entropy or other kinds of entropies, which are equivalent basically to knowing the spectrum of eigenvalues of this density matrix. So that's a whole set of observables in quantum field theory that we don't, we hadn't historically thought about very much, but clearly in the context of ADS, CFT, they could be relevant. One of the problems, it's all a bit subtle, because the actual entanglement entropy for any spatial region in a field theory, in a continuum field theory, is divergent, even if you're in a free field theory, and you have to do fancy things like defining the mutual information. So if you have two regions, you can define the mutual information in this way, and it turns out that the divergences from the entanglement entropy then cancel. So there are well-defined entanglement observables. But I don't really, so I want to get away from this. So this is completely tied to position space. This was directly related to my description in terms of the boundary, these patches that went out to the boundary. So what I wanted to ask was whether... Oh, sorry, A and B would be general regions. Yeah, so A, I should have had a picture there. So if I take two separate regions, then the idea is that when I calculate with a cutoff the entanglement entropy of the union of those two regions with the rest. So that includes, the union has the same boundary as the boundary of A plus the boundary of B, and the claim is that the divergence cancels.
A and B will complement B.
Then it would be exactly the same divergence. So a regularization of S of A would be to take, yeah. Okay. All right. So this is the essential thing that we need in order to define density matrices. And so you can ask, well, is there a nice way of decomposing the Hilbert space of a quantum field theory, which is not tied to position space? And of course, this is what you do on the first day in field theory class. You say that it's much more natural to think about your degrees of freedom in field theory and label them by momentum instead of position, because if you do that, then at least for simple quantum field theories, you realize you just have a whole bunch of harmonic oscillators. Okay. So by changing the variables here, you can map your free quantum field theory to a system of oscillators, and then for a bunch of independent oscillators, then of course the Hilbert space is a tensor product, and the factors in the tensor product are just labeled by basically all of the allowed particle states of your theory, so all of the allowed momentum. So it's kind of clear then Now, at least certainly for free field theories, you have this description, but then I can certainly choose this to work with the same basis of my Hilbert space when I start to modify the Hamiltonian. Okay, so it certainly looks like we should be able to find things like the density matrix for a particular momentum mode, or the density matrix for all of the degrees of freedom below a scale mu, et cetera. And so I think a natural question is, why don't we talk about this? Because we're always talking about the physics below some scale mu in a quantum field theory, so why have we never talked about the density matrix? And I guess the interesting thing is that we really have. So it turns out that even though we don't talk about it in that language, when you're doing Wilsonian renormalization, it's clear that the degrees of freedom below a scale mu are not in some pure state. They're in a mixed state. And one way of seeing that is that the Wilsonian effective action that we get by integrating things out, it has all sorts of higher time derivatives. And so there isn't really, you can't really write down a Hamiltonian and talk about the ground state of the Wilsonian effective action. Unless, yeah. Okay, so when I say Wilsonian effective action, I'm thinking about integrating out degrees of freedom labeled by momentum. Yes. I don't mean that. Yeah, that's important. Yeah, so that's important. When I say Wilsonian effective action here, I'm actually talking about integrating out down to some spatial momentum scale. Oh, well, okay. So what I was going to show is that actually the density matrix has a direct relationship to this action, this Wilsonian effective action where I integrate out down to some momentum scale. So this is kind of I won't derive this, but if you just ask, well, what is the path integral definition of this density matrix? So I want to define, so I want to think of the fields with momentum less than mu, and I want to say, okay, the density matrix, I'll try to write that in some position space basis. So you have a matrix with some arbitrary field configuration here, some arbitrary field configuration here. And you just follow the rules that you would use for writing down the state and path integral language and the density matrix for the whole thing, and then follow your nose. And what you end up with is this statement that density matrix is exactly, it's like a path integral transform of the Wilsonian action. So you have the Wilsonian effective action here. You've got your variables here are now just the low momentum modes, and then you have some boundary conditions where phi at t equals tau, this is Euclidean, tau equals minus infinity is phi hat, and phi at plus infinity is phi tilde. Okay. So it's literally true that when you do Wilsonian quantum field theory, you're using density matrices, and if I were to now insert an operator here and then integrate over everything, well, that's clear that you're now just you're just tracing over that density matrix with your operator insertion. Okay, so it's actually not, so this idea of density matrices in field theory, I think, is something that we don't, it's not part of the language so much, but in fact, it's a very natural thing, and we've been using it implicitly. That, in this case, I'm talking about the density matrix of the ground state, yes. Well, if I want to, that's just what the answer is. So this is the density matrix, period, and this is a Euclidean action. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. So there, it's a little bit more tied to position space. So there, they're typically thinking about a lattice kind of field theory, and then their goal is to think about a chunk of that lattice, and then there's a density matrix for that chunk. And at the next level, in some sense, you're trying to approximate that density matrix by throwing out some of the zeros or some of the very small eigenvalues. So it's a little bit tied to, it's more tied to position space. Although There's something related to that, which is this multi-scale entanglement renormalization ansatz, where your description of a ground state, so you have, again, some lattice system, and then your description of a ground state is, well, okay, so I'm not going to get this right. It's one of these tensor network type descriptions where you have some data which is labeled by a tree, and a big part of the data seems to be so the interpretation of the data here is how much it's sort of directly related to how much entanglement you have at a certain scale. So in this case, more or less directly, the data that encodes your ground state has to do with how much entanglement you have at various scales, and people have even pointed out that that's very similar to going to ADS CFT. I think Brian Swingle had a paper about that, and right. But yeah, I guess it's still a bit tied to position space, and it's an approximation technique. So I'd like to understand better if there's some kind of exact thing that people have talked about the continuum, but I haven't really understood if it's related. Okay. So once we accept that you have these density matrices, you actually get, you know, like the position space stuff, there's a whole bunch of observables in QFT that you can imagine defining. So take your favorite perturbative quantum field theory, and you can try to calculate the entanglement entropy for the momentum below, degrees of freedom below scale mu, or you could compute the entanglement entropy of a single quantum field theory mode. Actually, precisely, you need to look at the modes in some small region of momentum space. Or you can think about the mutual information between two modes, or just the spectrum of one of these density matrices. And so I guess to help convince myself that it's not all just formal BS. I should have said this is this last part I've been working with my student Mike McDermott and also Vijay Balasubramanian. Okay, so with these people, we've been trying to just do some simple, we start with the simplest example of the field theory, and it's kind of fun that you're calculating something for phi 4 that no one has calculated before, and you don't have to go to 12 loops or anything. So I'll just outline the calculation, and it's kind of obvious once you know what you're trying to calculate. So just to be careful, then I want to start with finite volume, and I could start with a UV cutoff and all of this so that I really know that everything makes sense. So I have momenta in this box which are on a lattice. And then basically the rule is that you're allowed to take any subset of those and try to calculate a density matrix and then an entanglement entropy, et cetera. Okay. So we said this already. The point is we're going to use the same basis once we turn on an interaction, and we want to turn on an interaction because it's clear that if you don't have any coupling, then as I said, the vacuum is just a tensor product state. Of course, you could look at more interesting states in the free field theory and ask about some of these observables. So that may be an interesting question as well. Okay. Yeah, I thought about this for about like a week in Aspen where I was trying to decide whether I should care about this or whether I should just ignore it. And I feel like even when we calculate, I feel like a lot of the calculations in field theory you could say the same thing for, and sure, that we ignore it and it's fine. So far I'm. I think it's a pedantic question. So for now, I'm going to be happy if I calculate the thing and it looks fine. So with, I mean, with the correlation functions, there's... Oh, for sure there's ordinary infinities that are dealt with by the regular way. But, we can talk more about that. But I have thought about it, and I've come to the conclusion that it's something that you could say about almost any quantum field theory calculation. And I looked in Tom Banks' book, I think he says this, and then I think his answer is that just think in the functional formalism and don't worry about it. All right, well, okay, I'm actually going to finish. So what's the structure when you turn on an interaction? So you can express this in quite general language. So you have a Hilbert space, which is a tensor product. It doesn't have to be a field theory. And if you have a Hamiltonian, which is H plus H2, H1 plus H2 plus lambda times some interaction, well, then you could just do perturbation theory, and you don't even. So now I'm just doing ordinary quantum mechanics perturbation theory. So the goal is you start with this state, which is the tensor product of the vacua for these two sectors, and then you try to compute in perturbation theory how the state gets modified, and you all know how to do that. And then when I compute that vacuum state, I could take the density matrix corresponding to that state. I could then trace over the high momentum degrees of freedom and calculate whatever I want to. So I'll try to do that in perturbation theory. And so I'll show you a formula which this applies for any system where you...
Yeah, I think I have one slide after this. But we were at the point of just saying if you have a quantum system which starts out in a product state, and your Hamiltonian is H1 plus H2, and then you add this interaction term, what does the formula for entanglement entropy look like in perturbation theory? And so the leading order formula looks like this. Actually, lambda squared log lambda squared, lambda was the thing in front of the interaction Hamiltonian. And then it's a sum over these matrix elements where you... Basically, it's all the matrix elements where you excite both parts of the system. So you sum over those squared matrix elements. E is the energy of this state, and I'm assuming the energy of this one is zero. Otherwise, there would be E minus E zero. Okay. So in field theory, then you could compute all of this stuff. You like just write down what the interaction Hamiltonian is in field theory. So then the interpretation of the sum is that you're looking at these matrix elements, and the sum is over state. So there's at least one particle with momentum less than u, and at least one particle with momentum greater than u. For the higher order contributions, there is a contribution from matrix elements that where n or big n would be zero, but the leading order is not. If you want to try to rewrite this ordinary quantum mechanics expression in terms of something that looks more like quantum field theory, you can do that, but you don't really have any insight to gain from that. One thing is that there are also order lambda squared terms, so similar order, which are more complicated to write down and to compute. You have to actually compute a bunch of eigenvalues. That's possible. We have one of these smart copiers at UBC that can tell which way the slides are supposed to be. I guess so. Yeah. It's pretty good. It got like 19 for 20. So that's pretty smart. Well, it comes from the fact that the entanglement entropy is rho log rho, and that rho as leading order has lambda. Okay, so this is my last slide. So just to show you some results, the very simplest calculations I can do are for 5-3 theory, it turns out, in D plus one dimension, so you can say the usual things about imagining that there are some even terms in the potential at higher orders that make it all consistent. I'm doing not just by cube theory, so like perturbative table. And so this is what it looks like in various dimensions. So the small mu behavior is basically governed by how many degrees of freedom there are. So remember, this mu is my cutoff. So we're saying how much entanglement is there for all of the modes with momentum less than mu with the rest of the mu. And so the small mu behavior for a massive theory seems to be basically governed just by how many degrees of freedom there are for mu. And then the large mu behavior, so it changes depending on the dimension, and it seems to be governed by both the number of degrees of freedom below mu, but then also it's important that the coupling in these theories will depend on the scale. So either you have a relative coupling, so it's effectively going with free theory at large mu, and you see that coming in. So here in 3.4 dimensions, that the growth of the number of degrees of freedom actually seems to dominate over that decrease in the coupling. Yeah, I know that. So you should divide by the number of degrees of freedom is going like a power of mu, the maximum possible entropy, I guess. Well, this is a quantum field theory, so. No, but they're harmonic oscillators, so. In a fermionic field theory, you have a maximum number of degrees of freedom. With a single harmonic oscillator, I can have an entanglement looks great. So the answer is that it would be awesome. I think that's a bit too naive.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You'd also expect the area by that argument outside of that is a zero. So for the growth of the number of degrees of freedom to overcome the fact that the coupling is relevant. Yes, the coupling is getting less and less relevant. Good. So it's lambda squared, log lambda squared, whatever that is in your chosen dimension. To make the large mu behavior dimensionless, that's all it takes. And so the only m that in the large mu behavior, the only m that appears is here, in 1 plus 1 dimension, you get this log.
That's over d.
I said at the beginning of this slide, it seemed easier to calculate it by
Q0.
Right, so one thing that seems interesting, or one thing that we don't understand yet, is that if I try to do this, so if I try to do it for 5.4 in 4 dimensions, then there are certain things like if I focus on finite regions of momentum space and ask about the mutual information between those, I get a sensible answer that I can compute in perturbation theory. But if I ask in that theory about the entanglement between some finite region of momentum space with the rest of the theory, then I simply get at least my perturbative answer gives me a divergence that comes from summing over all these other degrees of freedom. So that quantity is just something that can't be computed in perturbation theory. I mean, it can't. So the same divergence happens in a fermionic field theory where there is an absolute bound on the entanglement entropy. So in yeah, even so, it seems like if I push my dimension high enough, and I'm talking about a quantity where you're integrating out to infinity, where you're acting with a tangle between a large number of things. Yeah, then I can get a divergence, which is not cured by the usual renormalization of couplings. And I think I want to say that it's just not something that you can compute in perturbation theory, because a similar quantity in a fermionic field theory, I could just ask about the entanglement between one mode of a fermion with the rest of the system. And if I'm the dimension is too high, even in the renormalizable theory, I get a divergence in it. And there the entanglement entropy is really bounded by longitude. So I think it's just telling you that if you try to compute two inclusive a quantity entangling a number of things with other, then you can run into trouble. Okay, so yeah, that's I don't really have anything useful on the summary slide. I can't remember. I memorized the keystrokes to turn it upside down when before the talk. Sorry. Okay. Okay, so that's all I have. Well, I certainly do. I'm just talking about the vacuum state of a field theory, you know, and I'm looking at an observable that, you know, it's probably difficult to say what the signature of cluster decomposition is for that particular. I mean, it sounds like for cluster decomposition, you want to look at observable that refer to space. Yeah, so their power goes down. My student last week was talking about exactly that. He was okay. I believe what he said. And I haven't checked this. So I think what he said. This was in the context of these situations where you get a divergence. I think what he said is in all these cases where we're finding a divergence in the minimal dimension, then that mutual information seem to go like a
constant.
As a function of, yeah, so you increase yourself, yeah. Power law up to some point, and then it may be that the power law fall off up to some point, and then it sounds like in the places where we start to see these divergences,
wondering, since this area computes the entanglement of these degrees of freedom with the rest, what does that area
going to say that was a little bit of the motivation. You know, what is this? If you have a translation invariant state in the field theory, then this area as a function of radius is an observable something that you should correspond to something in the state. And what is it? If this area corresponds to entanglement between these degrees of freedom and the rest, then maybe that area corresponds to entanglement between the final rest. One of the things that confuses me about that is that you can have gravity duals of theories that don't have any spatial dimensions, such as major quantum mechanics. You have the gravity dual, and you have a similar observable on the gravity side, just the areas of spheres around your black hole or whatever. And well, we certainly don't have momentum states, so there should be some other. I think it's an important question to understand if there are even further ways of decomposing the Hilbert space. I mean, this is also relevant to the discussion of scrambling in GFSS. If you want to ask about things like scrambling, it's important to understand whether you could actually decompose the system so that they can ask whether there's. Yeah, it certainly depends on, you know, mainly the energy dependence of that coupling will play a big role in the power. Not for certain field theory circuits.